Dr. Coleman Ochter, child and adolescent psychotherapist, joins me now in studio to answer any parenting issues you might be facing. And we've announced that Coleman was coming in, so we have some here. Good afternoon, Coleman.
Afternoon, Ray. How are you keeping?
Good to see you. So we're out the other side of the exams.
Yes. Yeah. The real busy period for me now is usually kind of from mocks to leaving cert. It's busy on both sides. As an academic, you're doing a lot of marking and then you've obviously a lot of anxiety around that. So it's always kind of a peak time. But yeah, no, once that first exam is over, you can see the curve starting to...
Is there anything we could say to people now? Because people never refer to it after the fact. It's always in the lead up to it, you know. I suppose, like, you got... People got through it, didn't they? That's the thing, isn't it?
The wonderful thing about overcoming a crisis, which we need to always do, is recognise the effort that went into getting through it, but that we survived it. Because it's that survival that is the currency for when the next crisis is around. You're going to have to revisit that and say, well, I got through that, so I'll get through this. But we don't. We tend to forget that ever happened and keep going. For parents out there who had an anxious leaving cert student, junior cert student, now's the time to go back and say, because they can hear it now. Yes. They couldn't hear it when you're saying, oh, it's no big deal, blah, 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 on the 4th of June or whatever it was. But now you say, look how well you managed that. And if that happens again, remind yourself of how well you managed it and how you got through it. We miss that opportunity time and time again. It's always back to that thing of catch your kid being good, but catch them when they survive something. Not always just being recruited when they're struggling.
It's important, yeah. Coleman, I'm a grandmother of a highly intelligent eight-year-old. She's on perfect behaviour everywhere she goes. At bedtime, however, every night she creates a terrible fuss, saying things like, my mind won't let me go to sleep. I can't stop thinking of terrible things. Parents have practiced all the recommended routines faithfully. She is so loved by both parents, but I think she's able to manipulate them to get her way.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think the idea that granny thinks this child is being manipulative, but she's a perfect child during the day. Children don't become manipulative after night hours. So there may well be a manipulation to her behaviour, but my guess here is that this comes from an original case of anxiety or a real sense of anxiety. Children who are very agreeable, very conscientious, are oftentimes quite anxious, right? So oftentimes when it comes to bedtime or something like that, they might be down 100 times looking for a drink, or I'm scared, or there's a noise outside, or all that sort of stuff. And people can interpret that as them stalling or being quite deliberate, but they're not. They're just incredibly overwhelmed about being on their own, or their worries that they've stockpiled all during the day tend to come out at that time. And really, every behaviour has meaning. And so what looks like manipulation, there's a reason for the manipulation, is I don't want to be on my own, right? Okay. So in that situation, it's not about trying to push her back or push her away, but actually try and address what that underlying anxiety might be about. And oftentimes bedtime is not the time to do that because it's already peaked. So prior to bedtime or during the day, trying to have avenues to vent that out a little bit. But one of the things parents and grandparents, I think, misread or misinterpret is a behaviour that a child is very consciously trying to put you out. They're just trying to be difficult.
They're not.
90% of children's behaviour has an origin or meaning behind it, which may involve manipulation, but it's manipulation for survival, not for manipulation for manipulation's sake, if that makes sense.
And highly intelligent eight-year-old, could it be a phase?
Yeah. I mean, we talk about this, that idea of permanency starts to come into play, that age of reason. So when 7, 8, you start to realise, gosh, what I do impacts on other people, and what other people do impacts on me. And oftentimes you'll get high levels of anxiety. It's kind of a rite of passage almost, about a fear of falling asleep or a fear of not waking up or a fear of losing control. And lots of children will experience peak anxiety around that. And again, nighttime being one of the more common pieces with that. 70% of that is fine. They'll pass through it. It's a rite of passage that they'll find. Others might be a sign of something more sinister, more anxious temperament that might need a little bit more scaffolding around that time, a little bit more intervention. But from this point of view, it's peak time in her life for this to happen. It's peak time in the day for it to happen. So I wouldn't go into crisis mode in that, but trying to offer this child some sort of a valve where she can let out whatever it is she's worrying about in the daytime is probably going to help improve her sleep routine.
Great. Coleman, our five-year-old has a terrible fear of spiders and webs. In school, he went to the loo, saw a spider and was hysterical. Now he holds on to his toilet until he gets home, which is very bad for him, and has had a few accidents in school. We really would appreciate any help on how to handle this one.
Yeah, I'm going to give a really practical advice on this one, actually. This is an issue where the child is associating going to the toilet in school with the spider being there. the intervention needs to be at school level. So this is where a teacher, SNA or something, needs to go in with them, make sure there's no spiders and allow him to overcome that fear, because he's holding until he comes home and having accidents. That's what children do. They'll avoid, and they, and constipation and things like that can be, and holding in smaller children can be a real issue. And it's much more difficult to fix than it is to try and not let it happen in the first time. So for this, into the school, get someone to support him to overcome the fear of going in, so that holding doesn't become an option. But absolutely, that's where I would put that intervention.
Could it solve itself over the summer holidays or not?
Likely that, I mean, again, if he grows and matures over that 2-3 months period, that there could be a natural kind of progression where he's more confident in it, but not with phobia. The trigger usually, no matter what time the gap in between, it can reassociate.
It kicks in again.
Yeah.
Okay,
but I would be certainly tackling this early September should it happen. Yeah.
Okay. Awful problems trying to keep children off phones and devices and to help with household chores, getting angry responses, etc. Please help. I'm sure we're not alone. Oh, you're not alone. You're not alone at all.
Yeah, look, we've discussed this many times. Yeah. There isn't a silver solution answer that we just, this is how you fix that. Again, I think I go back to the idea of having a phone is a responsibility. It's not a human right. You earn the right by showing the responsibility. So ideally, if they're young enough, the household chores should be, the phone is contingent on those things being done, put those things in place. And I would even go as far as putting contracts out and signing it and saying, you know, so that we have an agreement to refer to. They're teenagers, so they're going to think everything you say is overreaction and irrelevant. So the contract just helps in that, where there's, you both agree to it. But this is an ongoing battle. There's no solution to that. This will be, if your children are 13, it's going to be like this for the next 7 years, you know, so.
And I don't want to be a pain in the behind, but, you know, monkey see, monkey does. And you know, we have to look at our own behaviour as well, don't we? That's not the whole problem. Like, the big tech companies have responsibility as well. But as parents, if we have our head in our phones all the time, we can't expect our teenage children not to do the same.
Yeah, and what we're seeing is, as the research comes out, that parental tech habits have a huge influence on children's tech habits. So I've said this before, like, you telling them to come off something while you're answering emails over breakfast is saying, eat your porridge, I'm going to have a packet of crisps. And it doesn't, they don't see that it's work related or you're doing something different. They just see you on your screen and they see that relationship. And there's this concept of technoference they're talking about at the moment, which is kind of that early childhood thing. So when children are kind of in the infancy and they see the parent with the phone all the time, that their association importance with this phone is as important as I am and I need to have it. And so, you know, right from that imprinting phase almost, that we're creating this third other within the room.
It's very sad. I see people, you know, with children in buggies and they're on their phone. You know, now the children could be asleep.
Yeah,
I'll accept that the children could be asleep. But if they're awake and they're looking up at mammy or daddy and looking for some sort of reaction and they're on a phone, that ain't good.
Yeah, look, I don't want to be grim on a Wednesday afternoon, but I think we will look back at this in 20 years' time thinking, what were we thinking?
What were we thinking,
know?
Yeah. Okay, you're not on your own, if that's any consolation whatsoever. Coleman, our 13-year-old has developed a really indifferent attitude to everything. We used to have great chats, but we barely get a grunt out of him now when he comes home from whatever he's doing. Is this the way it's going to be now? Is there any way of encouraging his former chatty self to emerge from sullen teenager under a cloud?
You're not on your own either. I would say that, no, look, there's a part of this, again, is a developmentally appropriate thing that I was in a few weeks back. The last time I was in, we were talking about Inside Out 2, the movie. But there's a lovely insight into everything that's going on for a teenager, biologically, puberty, psychologically, emotionally, socially, all that. And as a parent, you're just an interference in that process. You know, you come well down the pecking order, whereas a 9-8-year-old, you're at the top of the pecking order. So you've shifted, not through any fault of your own, but because other things have happened. So again, your work has to be different. It's not about reminding them, you used to be a nice boy and you're not anymore. That's not going to open them up. But what you are trying to do is find moments where they're not as distracted and use those kind
of
windows.
How do you find those?
Again, it's suck it and see, almost testing the waters, you know. People would oftentimes say driving in a car is easy when you're not staring at them in the face. It doesn't feel like shining a light in their face and interrogating them about how their day was, that sort of stuff. Usually when they're relaxed or enjoying something, that's where you might try and kind of find out a little bit about how they, or make that connection. But I always remember one kid saying to me, she said, my mom doesn't understand me, but I know she tries. And it's that, there's something about that empathy of, I don't know what you're going through, but I'd like to know, and I know it's something, and I'm here if you need me. It is a kind of an open door policy of, you know, you come to me and I'll offer my availability and my support. But a pursual of that can sometimes feel like you have an agenda, and the teenager ends up closing the door even more. So like the nature of that email is kind of, oh, is this the way it is? And it's kind of throwing your arms up in resignation. I'd change it to a much more empathy position. And I think you have a far more optimal opportunity of creating.
And as you say, you're not on your own. This is part of life.
Don't take it personally.
It's puberty, it's adolescence. And forever and ever and a day, that's what has happened to the human being.
The parents have said to me, what did I do? And I'm saying, you did nothing. You had a child that's now a teenager. That's all you did. You
know? I know it's difficult though, because you know you had this lovely relationship and now it's completely changed.
Well, if you had a friendship that just changed overnight, you'd think there has to be a reason for it. But in this case, there's not.
Well, I suppose here's the thing to say to parents all over there with teenage children. It's not about you.
No, it's not. It's not personal. Yes. And the other thing is, it comes around.
Yes.
When they're about 22,
we'll get them back.
They'll go, gosh, my mum was right.
Right. Coleman, thanks so much. That's Dr. Coleman Nocter. That's it from us. Cormac and Sarah on Drive Time. We are back tomorrow at 3 o'clock. Enjoy the rest of your Wednesday evening.